You get on base, we win. You don't, we lose. And I hate losing, Chavi. I hate it. I hate losing more than I even want to win. And there's a difference.
Now let me welcome everybody to the Wild Wild West, a state that's familiar like your favorite fleece vest, but it's feeling a little tight, a little snug on our chest. Take it down a couple notches. Take a few deep breaths. We in that limbo state when our minds playing tricksies. Resistance at the top, making us feeling tipsy. Gains turn to losses, that hasn't happened a lot lately. We forget that it's a market, it doesn't rise innately. When good news equals bad news, it doesn't make a lot of sense. If the economy's so strong, why are we playing defense? And corporate profits are getting better, isn't that a good sign? Let me take you back in history, let me press rewind. Take it back to 2020, 4 years hence. COVID shook the market, it fell 35%. Remember 08, the great financial crisis? The market cut in half, greed coming back to bite us. Or how about 99? It was really 2000. The dot-com bubble burst. Investors took a trouncing. 1987, bear market plus recession. That should have taught us all a lesson. These markets go in cycles. It's never a straight line. But the trend has been our friend. It just takes time. Add some patience and a plan. Sprinkle in compounding. You'll be shocked at the gains. It'll be astounding. Have perspective. Be objective. Don't let your emotions get the best. That's how we ride these rails together on the Investopedia Express. Welcome back and welcome aboard. And you may want to take your seats through these bends because it's getting a little choppy out there. U.S. equity markets are coming off their worst week of the year as inflation and a strong labor market put the pop back into treasury yields, which lets a little air out of stocks. It was another little taste of that old-fashioned good news in the economy translating into bad news for the stock market. That happens from time to time, although last week felt a little more ominous. Big gains for stocks on Wednesday morning turned into steep losses by the afternoon. A big swing, one of the biggest reversals we've seen in a long, long time. Another spike in commodity prices had something to do with that as well, as prices for everything from oil to copper to sugar and cocoa just keep ticking higher. Gold made yet another record high as the inflation drumbeat got a little bit louder, and by the time the dust settled on Friday, after a pretty big relief rally, the S&P 500 closed out the week down 1%, the NASDAQ lower by 0.8%, and the Dow tumbling 2.3%. That was not the start to the second quarter that many were hoping for, but equity investors have had little to complain about so far this year. Pullbacks happen. The U.S. labor market continued to defy expectations and estimates as employers added 303,000 jobs last month, far more than what was expected, and even though a good chunk of that hiring was for part-time jobs, they are still jobs, and there are plenty of full-time jobs available. Just to put the strength of the labor market in perspective, consider this. Not only were March payrolls higher than expected by about 100,000 jobs, January and February job gains were also revised higher, and the U.S. economy is averaging around 230,000 plus job gains every month for the past 12 months. That's a lot stronger than the 12 months preceding the pandemic when the average was around 170,000 job gains per month. And the unemployment rate has been below 4% for 26 straight months, the longest streak since the 1960s. Companies are feeling pretty confident for the most part, although we've seen tech, media, and now financial companies trimming their workforces. But job gains have been pretty steady and pretty strong in healthcare, government, and leisure and hospitality, and wages, up 4.1% for the year, are outpacing inflation. And that leads us directly into our big three for the week. Number one, back to that good news equals bad news paradigm we find ourselves back in again. If the economy's so strong and inflation is still hovering around 3%, cutting interest rates may seem a little rash anytime soon, even as soon as June. Yet, according to the CME's FedWatch tool, Fed Fund futures traders are still pricing in a 50% probability that the Fed will cut interest rates by a quarter point at the June 12th meeting, then maybe a potential pause at the July 31st meeting, and then maybe another quarter point cut at the September 8th meeting, which would put the Fed funds rate between 4.75% and 5%. That looks like it might be it for the year, if it happens at all. There's been a growing chorus among Fed officials like Atlanta Fed President Rafael Bostic and Minneapolis Fed President Neil Kashkari that maybe only one or zero rate cuts are appropriate this year. Higher for longer has shifted into higher until whenever, and that's going to add some friction into an otherwise well-greased economy. It hasn't slowed the stock market's steady march higher, that is, until last week. Was that a bull market breather or the beginning of a broader unwinding? We'll talk to Sam Stovall about that in a few minutes. Number two, higher until whenever interest rates also means higher savings, CDs, and money market account yields offering 5% that are going to be here for a while. That's been nice for savers and investors sitting on cash. And if we look at where the money's been flowing lately, it looks like those folks are getting a little more comfortable. According to B of A Securities, $81.1 billion flowed into money market funds in the last week of the last quarter. That was the largest pile in 16 weeks. To be sure, some of that was due to quarter-end rebalancing after a torrid first few months of the year for stocks. But there's now more than $6.1 trillion in money market funds and growing. About 40% of that is owned by individual investors like you and me, and we like cash. Remember, in our latest sentiment survey poll, 60% of you said you held money market funds or accounts, and half of that group intended to put that money to work in the stock market. Has the sentiment shifted? And number three, pull up to about 150,000 feet and look back about 15 years, and you'll see an unbelievable global wealth machine in action. I'm talking about the global stock market. As Bespoke Investments pointed out recently, the Bloomberg World Exchange market cap, which measures, as you probably guessed, the total market capitalization of all the world's stock exchanges, has risen from $25.5 billion in March of 2009 to $107 trillion as of last week. Believe it or not, that's not even a record high. That high was hit back in mid-November of 2021 when it hit $122 trillion. A big sell-off in China had something to do with that. But as of last Friday, it's been 867 days since the Bloomberg World Exchange Market Cap Index hit that record. That's the longest streak since 2003. Are we really in a stock market bubble, or do we just live in the era of really, really large numbers? Let's get set up for the week ahead, and inflation is back on the menu. We'll get the Consumer Price Index report for March on Wednesday, and that could come in a little hotter than February given rising energy prices. But economists are forecasting an annual rate of 3.1%. We're kind of stuck around here. Producer prices will come out on Thursday. Look for higher energy and commodity prices to weigh on those. Let's keep our eye on commodities. They're getting more and more expensive. And we're probably feeling it, and that's probably going to show up in the consumer sentiment survey out on Friday. We haven't stopped spending yet, and we usually don't slow down in the spring and the summer. And earnings season is back. No pressure, but companies kind of need to show out to keep investors from bugging out. So far, they have. They've been doing it for the past 4 years. If you look at the growth of the S&P 500, according to our pals at the Carson Group, of the 74% rise in the S&P since January of 2020, 48% of that comes from earnings growth, 17% comes from multiple growth, and 9% comes from dividends. It's the profit growth that we're here for. And for the first quarter, according to FactSet, the estimated year-over-year earnings growth rate for the S&P 500 is 3.2%. If 3.2% is the actual growth rate for the quarter, it will mark the third straight quarter of year-over-year earnings growth for the index. Voila! Something to keep an eye on, though. FactSet says 79 companies in the S&P 500 have already issued negative earnings guidance and 33 have issued positive earnings guidance. Are they sandbagging? We're going to find out this week when we hear results from widely held companies, including Delta Airlines, Constellation Brands, plus big banks including JP Morgan, Wells Fargo, Citigroup, and BlackRock, the world's largest asset manager. High interest rates cut two ways for banks. They improve their net interest margin since they borrow low and lend higher. But if rates are too high, there's not a lot of borrowing going on or investment banking. After a smashing first quarter start to the year for the stock market, investors were met with a reality hit check to start the second quarter, to say the least. Despite Friday's little rebound, last week was this year's worst, and it included the biggest daily drop in the Dow Industrials in a year. Now, let's keep it real. The S&P 500 is up 25% since its October 2022 lows when this bull market started running, and there's been almost no volatility. Debates about interest rates and inflation rage on, but the stock market, it's just been grinding higher through it all. But pullbacks and reversals, they never feel good, and they get our animal spirits all fired up. So let's put some perspective around those with Sam Stovall, one of our favorite market watchers and the chief investment strategist at CFRA. Welcome back to The Express, Sam.
Happy to be here. Thanks for inviting me.
I love your notes because you actually do put things in long-term perspective, which as investors we need. So make us feel a little bit better about this recent pullback and give us the long-term historical perspective on market performance in general.
Sure. Well, I think the reason I do what I do is because I'm trying to extract investors' emotions from the equation so that they don't become their portfolio's worst enemy. Basically, volatility is what happens on a regular basis. And so forewarned is forearmed. If you know that a decline is likely to occur anytime down the road, then you're more apt to withstand it rather than panic and run from it. But as we entered 2024, I was reminded that good years tend to follow great years. that the S&P gained an average of 10% in all years after we had a 20% or higher rise. And remember, last year we were up 24.2%. Then on January 19th, we recovered everything that we lost in the prior bear market. And history then tells us that, you know, we can advance another 5 to 8% or so over a two-month period before falling into a decline that averages around 8%. So a typical pullback or digestion of recent gains. Then when we concluded March and we had posted the 11th strongest first quarter since World War II, we're reminded again that 13 of these top 15 observations experienced declines in excess of 5% on an intra-year basis, falling an average of 11%. And actually, 8 of those 13 then had a follow-up decline averaging 12.5%. Yet by year end, 14 of those 15 observations were higher by double digits, with the average gain being more than 20%.
Right. So history does show us that we get these pullbacks. They're just a part of the market. People forget this is a market, buyers and sellers, and there is emotion out there, a heavy emotion out there. So yeah, you said, took the words right out of my mouth. Good years usually follow great years. This has been a pretty good year and a pretty good strong start to the year. Any reason why that shouldn't play out this year?
I don't think so. I think what's happening is that investors are reacting once again to the likelihood that the Fed will be slower to lower interest rates. And instead of getting 6 cuts, as was anticipated earlier in the year, starting in March, we'll probably end up with at most 3 cuts starting in June. Still, Fed funds futures call for a greater than 50% likelihood that it will start in June. But now I think a lot of investors are pushing it out. Maybe a July start, maybe only 1 cut, which occurs after the election. So we'll have to wait and see how this plays out.
Yeah, there's always a knee-jerk reaction to that when we hear different Fed presidents speak throughout the course of the week, or Fed Chair Powell is giving testimony or whatever it is. It does cause the animal spirits to wake up a little bit and start chirping. That said, don't you think investors are kind of beyond the concern about when the Fed's going to cut rates? We've kind of got used to this high rate environment, got a bull market out of it last year. Companies are actually growing their earnings. You note in your recent note, their earnings are forecast to grow 3.1% for the first quarter, and 6 out of the 11 S&P sectors are expected to grow earnings with double digits. And these were the big growth sectors. So have companies just gotten used to the new normal and investors are getting used to that as well?
Well, I think that it was already built into the market that the S&P 500 is now trading at a more than 30% premium to its average forward PE ratio going back 20 plus years. So I think that's a bit of a concern. When we look to those sectors that have posted all-time highs, the S&P posted 22 of them, but we had healthcare, financials, industrials, tech, post a multiple all-time highs along with the NASDAQ, the Dow, et cetera. So, you know, I think that possibly we've just gotten a little bit too far ahead of ourselves. And as you and I were discussing before the formal interview, there are a lot of anecdotal indicators out there of sentiment that do point to essentially an overly optimistic investor marketplace.
Yeah, it's kind of weird when you have our sentiment survey, the most positive it's been in a year. You have the AAII sentiment survey of individual investors, pretty bullish, the most bullish it's been in a while. CNN Fear and Greed, one we both follow pretty closely. That's heavily into the greed. But it also institutional investors are feeling about as bullish as they have in a long time, very overweight equity. So when everyone's running the same direction, as a market historian, as a strategist, as someone who studies cycles, does that worry you at all?
Yes, it does. To show my age, I'll refer to an old Colombian coffee commercial where the announcement is Colombian coffee now being served on the starboard deck. And then you see the boast list to the right. Well, if everybody's on the starboard deck, if everybody has already bought into stock prices, who's left to either support or propel those prices? So once we start to get something that serves as a catalyst for correction, and I think we're seeing that now with the rise in the 10-year yield, with the concern that the Fed will wait to start cutting interest rates, and an increase in tension in the Middle East, I think those factors are what's causing investors to start second-guessing themselves and look to possibly take some profits.
Yeah, and taking profits is part of the game as well. We know that happens as part of market cycles. Let's go back to the earnings part for just a second, because this is pretty strong earnings growth, and everybody was worried about a recession last year. Maybe we'll get one this year, who knows, but it doesn't look like it. But you note that the sectors that are growing the strongest are consumer discretionary, communication services, information technology sectors. These have been the fastest growing parts of the stock market. Up until kind of this year, the deepest declines are going to come from energy, healthcare, and materials groups. So why have we seen the sector rotation into energy and materials lately? Is that price driven because the price of oil is high and there is geopolitical tension?
Yes, I think it's the latter. It's basically the geopolitical tensions in the Middle East. Energy tends to be an inflation hedge. And also there are embryonic forecasts of a renewed Chinese recovery. So I think those factors together are providing some support to energy, but also to materials, to industrials. Gold certainly is leading the way. And really, you have to look at the technicals for gold, and looking at a point and figure chart forecast, about 2,600 is the estimate as to the near-term target, if you will, for gold prices. So with that in mind, investors are saying, okay, well, again, if double-digit gains are already factored into a lot of these growth areas, and we're likely to then see some profit-taking in those areas that were up more than 50% on average in 2023, had a very strong first quarter of 2024. Again, I think it ends up being sort of a near-term situation where it's really just sort of skimming the foam off of the Guinness. And so history again tells us that following up years, you want to let your winners ride, because the four best performing sectors from an up year on average tend to outperform the S&P 500 in the subsequent year about 2 out of every 3 years.
Yeah. Well, we're also seeing finally some strength in mid caps, small caps, a little bit of a rebound there. So is this kind of normal? You know market cycles well. You know also sector rotation, and you know how it works intra-market. Should we not be surprised to see this lingering inflation, right? High interest rates, geopolitical uncertainty, yet risk on for some equity asset classes, but there's also just general improvement sort of from up and down the market size.
Well, the only problem is that now good news is becoming bad news because we had stronger than expected March employment data. We've been seeing an improvement in U.S. economic data. Inflation figures have been coming down, but not as rapidly as they had been over the past year. The good news is that the economy is strong. We're going to sidestep a recession. People are getting jobs. The bad news is it's going to cause the Fed to wait and to start cutting interest rates later than people had anticipated. And the worry then is, well, gee, what's going to happen to the prospect of a recession? If we keep rates higher for longer, could that increase the likelihood of recession? And I think that's one reason why we're seeing real estate turn down once again. But right now, when you look at mid and small cap stocks, you're absolutely correct. They are currently trading at 25% and 33% respectively in terms of a relative PE discount to the S&P 500 average over the last 20 years. So mid-caps off 25% on a relative valuation basis, small caps down 33%, you would think investors would be piling into them. But because they are the ones to be most vulnerable during a recession and during sticky interest rates, I think that's probably the reason why people are nibbling rather than taking huge chunks.
All right. You also like to look at technical indicators, and you have this great mix of both technical and fundamentals, and also the macro views in your notes, which we will link to in the show notes, folks. So what technical indicators are you looking at, or do you look at on a daily basis that may, you know, pique your interest a little bit or get your attention and maybe get an ear to go up and give you a little flashing warning sign?
Sure. Well, I like to say that fundamentals tell you what, but technicals tell you when and how far. So I like to look at both of them. And so I simply monitor the 153 sub-industries within the S&P 1500. That's the combination of the large cap 500, mid cap 400, small cap 600. And when we had the percentage above at least one standard deviation for those above their 10-week or 50-day moving average, those above their 40-week or 200-day, and those above both indicators, they were recently well above that threshold at which it says, you know, we're a bit overbought and it's probably time to take some profits. So now we are coming down from that. So it could take a while, I think, before the nervousness plays out and the relative strength then indicates it's time to move back in.
For most investors, Sam, not the professionals that you advise, but individual investors and do-it-yourselfers and even folks that work with advisors, index investors for the most part, who are just contributing to their retirement funds and their 401ks, et cetera. What do you advise in times like this? Is just a standby and let it happen type of thing? Keep your plan on plan and keep contributing? Or is this a time where you want to sit back a little bit and watch how things play out?
I think you sit back a little bit, watch how things play out. I do look to Fibonacci retracement levels, even though I can't spell the word correctly all the time. So right now, the first level of retracement would bring us down to about 5,000 on the S&P 500. And the second Fibonacci level would be bringing us down to about 4,800. So those are targets that I might share with investors. But what I really try to do is to remind them the speed with which the market gets back to break even. We have had more than 60 pullbacks since World War II, and these are when the market is rising and then they fall anywhere from 5 to 10%, but then turn around and recover everything that they lost before eclipsing the 10% threshold. Corrections are 10 to 20%. So you're in a correction mode until you recover everything you lost, but also did not fall more than 20%. Well, the interesting thing is that about 86, 88% of all declines of anywhere from 5 to 20% got back to break even in an average of only 4 months. So 86 plus percent of all declines of 5% or more got back to break even probably by the time you would have worked yourself up into a frenzy enough that you would start harassing your financial advisor to start lightening up your portfolio of equities. By that time, if your advisor said, fine, if I just get you to stop calling me, I'll do it. By then, the market's probably already on its way back to break even.
Yeah. Translation, folks. Trends revert to the mean. The mean in this stock market is usually up and to the right to the tune of 9 to 10% a year. Not every year, of course, but that's why we play this game for the long term. That is the trend. All right. What's not getting enough attention from your point of view, Sam, out there in the markets that we might want to put on our radar?
Well, I'm not sure that I really know a lot more than other investors out there. It's more a matter of how am I going to react to it. I mean, you have bear markets that traditionally are triggered by unanticipated events. And I therefore like to say that unanticipated events are hard to anticipate. So basically, you have to realize that pullbacks happen about once a year. Corrections happen about once every other year. We've had 14 bear markets since World War II, so they happen as well. But usually you are better off buying than you are bailing. And just don't let emotions rule the day. Don't let your emotions tell you to load up just as we're about to hit all-time highs and then to bail out once we are near the bottom. So I would basically say, understand history, allow it to become virtual Valium so your emotions don't end up overriding your overall goals.
That is sound advice. And that's exactly why we reach out to you, just to calm us down a little bit when things get a little hairy around here. All right, let's go out on this. You know, Investopedia is a website built on our investing in finance terms. You have a huge, huge book of investing in finance terms that you've accumulated over your lifetime. What's your favorite investing term of the moment right now?
Well, my favorite investing term really, I think, points back to one of the strategies that I highlighted in my book, The 7 Rules of Wall Street. And that is, who says there's no free lunch on Wall Street? Free lunch is getting something for nothing. If you can get a higher return with lower risk, to me, that is something for nothing. Everyone thinks you have to have 20, 30, 50 stocks in your portfolio in order to have a truly diversified portfolio. Well, actually, you can accomplish that with only 2 sectors. If the technology sector is the poster child for growth, but also volatility, what is the reverse of that? It's essentially consumer staples. When the going gets tough, the tough go eating, smoking, and drinking. So basically, a portfolio of 50% tech, 50% consumer staples rebalanced annually actually earned you 96% of the return of tech alone, but with 40% lower volatility. So you ended up with a portfolio, 50% tech, 50% staples, that beat the market, but also was like an inch away from technology's compound annual growth rate since 1990 with substantially lower volatility.
There is free lunch if you know what to do. And folks, that strategy has worked for a very long time, at least for several generations. And I don't see any reason why it should change. Thanks for the perspective. As always, Sam Stovall, the Chief Investment Strategist at CFRA. Thanks for coming back aboard the Express. We appreciate you. And we will link to your great book and your notes in the show notes.
My pleasure. Thanks for inviting me.
It's terminology time. Time for us to get smart with the investing and finance term we need to know this week. And this week's term comes to us from... It's Kiss. And who doesn't want to rock and roll all night and party every day? The legendary glam metal band made a big move in the NIL arena last week. That's name, image, and likeness for all you Terminators out there. According to the world's greatest website, NIL is a set of rules originally established to govern the rights of college and high school athletes to benefit financially from the use of their name, image, or likeness for commercial purposes, such as product endorsements. But NIL is now extending way beyond high school and college athletics, and it's only getting bigger. KISS sold its entire catalog and its name, image, and likeness for $300 million to Sweden's Pop House. That means Pop House can use the legendary likenesses created by Gene Simmons, Paul Stanley, Ace Frehley, and Peter Criss for whatever it wants. Recreate the band, make an amusement park, video games, although KISS Pinball is already a thing. But this is not the first time a big recording artist has sold its name, image, and likeness for big money. Influence Media Partners, which is backed by BlackRock, included NIL rights when it bought Enrique Iglesias' catalog last year. We're going to let the late, great Jack Bogle take us out this week. With the eclipse this Monday and markets getting a little shaky, here's Jack's little reminder for investors to not go acting like Chicken Little around here.
25% drop, 35% drop is easily possible. It's always possible just because markets are markets. So I think the questioner is right to say, you know, what should I do? And I guess the answer generally is don't do something, just stand there.
Just stand there. Thanks, Jack. And thanks to all of you for riding the Express this week, as always. And a special thanks to Sam Stovall for coming back aboard. It's always good to get his perspective. We'll share his latest notes in our show notes, along with all the other reports we cited on this week's episode. Find those wherever you ride the Express. Don't stare at the sun. And we'll talk again a little further on down the line.